Well, today we will take up chapter 20, the philosophy of rebirth. Well, as I told you, from here onwards, we have chapters which are, we can say, typically ala Sri Aurobindo. That is, Sri Aurobindo gives a completely new turn to many of the established concepts. And then in the last six chapters, he gives completely his own philosophy. But even if you have to speak about the new being, the Gnostic being or the spiritual person or the superman, whatever we want to call it, it's necessary to go first from this chapter. It's necessary to understand the philosophy of rebirth. Because if we do not accept the philosophy of rebirth, then we cannot really conceive of a superman or a Gnostic being. So it is as important as that. To be able to conceive of the superman, you have to accept the theory of the rebirth. That is perhaps one of the difficulties in any other philosophy, be it in the West or in the East. Those philosophies which do not accept the rebirth theory will not be able to conceive of the possibility of the superman or the Gnostic being. Well, of course, in India we have had this concept right from our beginning of our culture, because the belief in rebirth assumes that you believe in the soul. And if you do not believe in the soul or the psychic being, whatever, then you cannot conceive of rebirth. Of course, there are theories which believe in the soul, believe in rebirth, and yet they do not believe or they cannot conceive of the possibility of a superman. So you see, there are three things. One, you should believe in the soul. Then second, you must believe the rebirth of the soul. And third, you must understand why is the soul taking up a rebirth. Because it could be that people say, well, there is a rebirth, sure enough, but it's just a play. It just, you know, it has no ultimate end or purpose. Like, you know, as the Gita itself says, that the soul throws out the old body and puts on a new body. As we have, as a man casts from him his worn-out garments and takes others that are new, so the embodied being casts off its bodies and joins itself to others that are new. So it could stop there. Takes new bodies, but what for? There's no particular aim. But here comes Sri Aurobindo saying no. It's not just for the heck of it. It's not just because, you know, I got a worn out shirt, I throw it out and I get a new one. That of course we all do, but we have no particular aim. But Sri Aurobindo brings in the third element, which is of the utmost importance. The first two steps, yes, many cultures, many religions have fulfilled the conditions. But wherein comes Sri Aurobindo is in his third condition, that the main purpose of rebirth is for the evolution of the spiritual man. That's the key sentence. Otherwise, this philosophy would have no meaning. So this is where we see the new concept that Sri Aurobindo brings in. And in this chapter, of course, he has, as usual, brought in different schools of thought about rebirth, and then shown us the weakness about these schools of thought, and then towards the end, he brings in his own, the third point that I said. So it is a longish chapter, about 20 pages. But I'm afraid it is a very fundamental chapter for the remaining 9 chapters. So I for one would really divide the Life Divine, the last 10 chapters or 8 chapters, chapter 20 to 28. So these make one chunk, because fundamental to the belief or the Gnostic being is the theory of the rebirth. And perhaps it is so important that Sri Aurobindo has dealt with this theory in other books also. In volume 16 you will see a series of articles on birth, on rebirth, theory of karma. So that makes another series. But here we have almost 3 chapters, the philosophy of rebirth, the order of the worlds and rebirth and other worlds. You see, this is a trial. And of course, it goes without saying that if we believe in rebirth, we have to believe in other worlds, supra-physical worlds. And for example, in Greek philosophy, Pythagoras had talked about rebirth. He talked about the soul. But then he misses out the question of the other worlds. He said that there is a direct transmigration. That means the soul, you know, just like we take out one shirt and put on another one immediately. So he says the souls leave one body and immediately take up another body. So for him, the travel into the other worlds doesn't exist. So perhaps we should maybe, it would be right to add this point in our 3 points. So make this as a third point. Soul, rebirth, then the other worlds, and then the question of the meaning of the rebirth, which is, it is there for the evolution of the spiritual man. If you do not believe in the evolution of spiritual man, then the whole theory goes astray. Well, this is kind of the skeleton idea, if I can say, of this chapter. And maybe if time permits, well, time will permit because we are not in a hurry to finish anything. But I would like to bring in the other chapters also from volume 16. So here, if you can keep these points in mind, then we can perhaps start with the reading of the chapter. And in Indian philosophy, this question of rebirth has been dealt with right from the Gita and onwards. But it has never given this question of of the evolution of man. You see, that's how everything in Sri Aurobindo hinges upon the single thought of evolution. Well, we will take up all these ideas as we go along with the reading. Let's start with the quotation. "An end have these bodies of an embodied soul that is eternal. It is not born nor dies, nor is it that having been it will not be again. It is unborn, ancient, everlasting. It is not slain with the slaying of the body. As a man casts from him his worn out garments and takes others that are new, so the embodied being casts off its bodies and joins itself to others that are new. Certain is the death of that which is born, and certain is the birth of that which dies." That's from the Gita, chapter 2. "There is a birth and growth of the self. According to his action, the embodied being assumes forms successively in many places. Many forms, gross and subtle, he assumes by force of his own qualities of nature." Shvetashvatara Upanishad. Now I take up the main reading. And this is a very oft-quoted line in Sri Aurobindo's. "Birth is the first spiritual mystery of the physical universe. Death is the second, which gives its double point of perplexity to the mystery of birth. For life, which would otherwise be a self-evident fact of existence, becomes itself a mystery by virtue of these two, which seem to be its beginning and its end, and yet in a thousand ways betray themselves as neither of these things, but rather intermediate stages in an occult processes of life." A very poetic, in fact, highly poetic language here. Well, you understand the meaning. The first line is very clear. "Birth is the first spiritual mystery of the physical universe." So he doesn't say birth is a mystery. Well, the biologists will say, no, it's no more a mystery, we know everything about it. So he says it's a spiritual mystery. Why is there this birth? And then death is the second mystery, which gives a double point of perplexity to the mystery of birth. So you see, in our life, I mean, at every point in life, I suppose, we do come across these two points of birth and death. In fact, if you see Savitri, the whole process is nothing but this birth and death. Death of Satyavan, birth of the new world. So this essential feature, as he calls it here, I mean the double point of perplexity, is again the foundation of even Savitri. So we see, is there anything called really birth and death? So he says, "For life, which would otherwise be a self-evident fact of existence, becomes itself a mystery by virtue of these two, which seem to be its beginning and its end." So we always calculate our life between these two, birth and death. But then what happens? and yet in a thousand ways betray themselves as neither of these two things, but rather intermediate stages in an occult processes of life. So there's no question of birth and death. It is an eternal process. We, in our narrow vision, we calculate the date of birth and the date of death. And we think that it is the human being, that person was born and is dead and is gone. But for that eternal vision, these are little stages. You know, it's like, you know, when we are going from here to Delhi by train, you come to a station. You stay there for a while. Some people get down, some people get up on the train, and then the train moves. So for the person who is inside the train, he says, yes, there has been a stop, I spent half an hour here, but I am not dead, I am not over. So after 45 minutes of this train halting in the junction, you go on. So that interim junction, that period when you stay upon this earth in a particular body, in a particular junction of life, is one experience. So the whole thing is a journey, an eternal march. So he says, actually that is the occult processes of life, in which birth and death are only significant intermediate stages. At first sight, birth might seem to be a constant outburst of life in a general death, a persistent circumstance in the universal lifelessness of matter. On a closer examination, it begins to be more probable that life is something involved in matter, or even an inherent power of the energy that creates matter, but able to appear only when it gets the necessary conditions for the affirmation of its characteristic phenomena and for an appropriate self-organization. Well, that's what we see, at least in nature, the splendid burst of life. Let there be rain, and you see the bursting of grass, bursting of plant, bursting of new leaves in summer. I mean, you see in winter, we don't see that much in India, maybe at least not in South India. We see a lot in Europe. During Christmas time, you see in the winter, not a leaf, the dead black branches of a tree. But then spring comes and suddenly the whole thing is afresh, blooming with flowers. So we wonder what's happened. A dead tree, almost seemingly dead, we almost call it dead matter, and burst with life now. So this is what he says here, that everywhere there is a birth seems to be a constant outburst of life in a general death. But then if you go and see closer, you ask the botanist, he says, no, the tree is not dead. There is all the energy. Why does a tree, shed off all its leaves in winter? It conserves its energy. It pulls back all the energy that is there in the leaves and in the flowers, pulls them back because it needs all the energy and the heat to sustain itself. The trunk and the branches need to sustain themselves. So there is this question of the energy being pulled back. And when summer comes, it again releases that energy. So he says, on a closer examination, it begins to be more probable that life is something involved in matter, is there already, or even inherent power of the energy that creates matter. You see, that's what we see, that is it that matter is really releasing life, or is it that matter itself is being released by a precedent thing called energy? So what comes, what is important is, first there's energy which translates itself into matter, and then the same energy using matter, he says, when there is a particular characteristic, when it gets necessary conditions of the for the affirmation of its characteristic phenomena. You see, we say on moon there is no life, Or on Jupiter there is no life. But there is matter. There is energy. So why is it that there is no life on Moon or Jupiter or Mars? So we should not say, we should not be, limited by this understanding. There is energy, there is matter, and hence life will appear. No, it's not necessary. Life will appear only when it gets the necessary conditions for the affirmation of its characteristic phenomena. So the energy also will burst into life only if there are particular conditions and characteristic phenomena and for an appropriate self-organization. So you see, this kind of the scientists may keep debating, is there life on Moon, is there life on Jupiter? They say we can't even create some life out of the plants or out of the matter of the Moon. They brought back to the earth some chunks of earth. But then it's not just the chemical components that are important. You see, the scientists may say whatever there is, oxygen, hydrogen and this matter, I don't know what the formulas are, they are all available there. And yet the question is, then why isn't life there? Can the scientists go settle down there and create life? Well, the question is, you may be able to create the chemical component, but is it, are you able to create the appropriate self-organization? You see, there's a consciousness which has to conceive of the necessity of life upon Moon. Because once the life comes, the green plants come, then the scientists may say, we want the animal also. But then the question is, why should another planet repeat what's happening upon Earth? Just because we have here matter, plant, crawling creatures, then you have the running creatures, then you have the man. So this has been the process here, but why do you want to imitate that there? Because the life energy there or the energy there might want to experience the divine manifestation in its own manner. That's what we have to fundamentally understand by this question of appropriate self-organization of its life, of its aim, of its evolution. And that is why the earth is so very important. That there are not only characteristic conditions of characteristic phenomena chemically, but also there is a consciousness which has organized itself in this manner that I will evolve from form to form and ultimately give birth to the God, to the divine in the physical. But all this is not there. And it cannot be there in other planets because, as the mother says, this evolution is there only upon earth. So when there is no design of the divine for evolution upon another planet, why should there be all these questions of life and animal and plants and all that? So Sri Aurobindo says, and then you see the next sentence, this is marvelous. He says, but in the birth of life there is something more that participates in the emergence. There is an element which is no longer material, a strong upsurging of some flame of soul, a first evident vibration of the spirit. That is the most important thing. The scientists think which we can have all the chemicals put together and give birth to a green plant. But in the bursting of this life, there is the upsurging of some flame of soul. And then which is a first evident vibration of the spirit. That's the most important sentence. I wish scientists would understand this. Try as much as you can, as much as you want. It is not the design of the spirit. It is not the divine commandment. Because there's a birth, or the bursting, or Sri Aurobindo says, upsurging of the soul itself. That soul which we in ourselves we call psychic being is born there. That's the first vibration of the spirit. So it's not that just because of the chemical that life is born. Because the divine himself expressing, wanting to express himself in life, and for the first time there is the birth of the soul. And remember, it is that soul, out of its innumerable births, travels and then becomes the psychic being, the human being. So if there's no soul, there's no evolution. And if there's no evolution, there's no meaning in having the greenery and the animals and all that. So, you see, how much is there behind this question of the rebirth? All the known circumstances and results of birth presuppose an unknown before, and there is a suggestion of universality, a will of persistence of life, an inconclusiveness in death, which seem to point to an unknown hereafter. Remember these two phrases, unknown before and an unknown hereafter. That is birth, rebirth. We are born, we assume a name and a form and a place and a culture, whatever, but we have an unknown before. All our previous births we don't know. And then we have an unknown hereafter, after this life, I don't know. The mid-stage is what we call life, you and me. But otherwise, look at this wonderful thing, unknown before and unknown hereafter. And there is a suggestion of universality, a will of persistence of life, and inconclusiveness in death which seem to point to an unknown hereafter. And you see, all the known circumstances and results of birth presuppose an unknown before, which only means that there is a suggestion of universality. Because we don't know what we were. Maybe the journey was millions of years. I have no idea. And then that there's a will of persistence of life. The moment I say I am born, that means I was there, my soul was there on the level of the grass of the first sprouts of life. But in spite of all the time facing death, millions of times it faced death, but a millions of times again it took a form. So a persistence of life, it never leaves. So an inconclusiveness in death. So ultimately, what is death? Can death stop this journey? It cannot, and it does not. Because the one who is reborn from birth to birth is deathless himself. Is only the changing of the form. And even this form is so persistent. Just because, you know, the animal has come, the fauna has not gone away. All the greenery is still there. All the animal kingdom is still there. All the bird kingdom is still there. And yet man has come. So there is the persistence of life in spite of the disappearance of forms. At every second, millions of forms are gone, millions of forms are born. So he said, this is the strange mystery, the unknown before and the unknown hereafter. What were we before birth and what are we after death are the questions, the answer of the one depending upon that of the other, which the intellect of man has put to itself from the beginning without even now resting in any final solution. The intellect indeed can hardly give the final answer, for that must in its very nature lie beyond the data of the physical consciousness and memory. whether of the race or the individual. Yet these are the sole data which the intellect is in the habit of consulting with something like confidence. In this poverty of materials and this incertitude, it wheels from one hypothesis to another and calls each in turn a conclusion. Moreover, the solution depends upon the nature, source and object of the cosmic movement. And as we determine these, so we shall have to conclude about birth and life and death, the before and the hereafter. So obviously this question of what were we before and what are we after death cannot be answered by the mind, by the intellect. Because the data that the intellect collects, in say nowadays in psychology, is insufficient. There are psychologists trying to really go back into, you know, previous births and all the prenatal stage to find out the cure for diseases. But he says all this data is insufficient. Yet these are the sole data which the intellect is in the habit of consulting with something like confidence. In this poverty of materials and this incertitude, it wheels from one hypothesis to another. So obviously the mind cannot deal with something that's not only beyond mind, but something which is beyond the ken of mind. Because you see, what we are not understanding is that the rebirth is taken by something, soul or the psychic being, which cannot be grasped by the intellect. So you may collect all the data of patients and keep a data of, you know, 50 patients of their previous lives, etc. But that will not suffice to really ultimately to give us an answer, a conclusive answer. So he says, now we shall take up these three questions of birth, life and death, because the solution depends upon the nature, source and object of the cosmic movement. This is what we are emphasizing. Unless we know the meaning, the raison d'etre of this existence, of this life, we cannot find out the answer of before and hereafter. So you see, this is where the fourth point that I was telling you comes into picture. Unless and until you find out the why of this creation, the answer will always elude you. The first question is whether the before and the after are purely physical and vital, or in some way and more predominantly mental and spiritual. If matter were the principle of the universe, as the materialist alleges, if the truth of things were to be found in the first formula arrived at by Bhrigu, son of Varuna, when he meditated upon the eternal Brahman, matter is the eternal, for from matter all beings are born, and by matter all beings exist, and to matter all beings depart and return, then no further questioning would be possible. The before of our bodies would be a gathering of their constituents out of the various physical elements through the instrumentality of the seed and food and under the influence perhaps of occult but always material energies, and the before of our conscious being a preparation by heredity or by some other physically vital or physically mental operation in universal matter, specializing its action and building the individual through the bodies of our parents, through seed and gene and chromosome. That's the scientist view. See, the scientist will not really look into the before. He says, yes, what was before was the gene. The gene, the chromosomes, that the parents pass on to the children. So because the scientist says, why do you have to look something for something that is before? Because if matter is the ultimate thing, there is nothing beyond matter, everything is in matter. So they try to find the source and the cause of the birth in matter. So that is why, you see, that's the example he gave about Bhrigu. And all of you know the story from the Upanishads, so I won't repeat it. He says the first reality and the only reality and the ultimate reality is matter. And that is a truth that was remarkably caught in the Upanishads, a truth that we in modern times are again repeating. That is, matter is the sole reality. So what Bhrigu found out was true. In the evolutionary pattern, every culture, every man, we all think that matter is the ultimate true reality. But rarely does mankind go to the second level. When Bhrigu was asked to go back by Varuna, who said, go and meditate again for 12 years. When Bhrigu comes back to his father and says, Father, now I know life is the supreme reality. Life is Brahman. Then he goes back, finds out the third one, that mind is Brahman. So now you see, modern times we believe in the first stage. Evolutionary wise, we are really in the beginning when we say matter is the ultimate. So the scientist is saying, you don't bother about a soul and how you are born and why you are born, all that is nonsense. You are matter, you are born out of the genes and the chromosomes passed on by the parents, and they have found out the ratio of X chromosomes and Y chromosomes, and then the combination of that would be a girl or a boy, and all that they have found out. So for them it is a plain truth. He says, even to ask such a question, what were you before this birth, is silly. Because what were you before this birth? You were nothing. You are born the moment your parents conceive. So that is the beginning. So you see, for them the beginning is the conception. And the beginning is a conception which is rooted in just the chromosomes. And these chromosomes pass on genes from your parents, and there comes in the question of the heredity. Whatever good or bad your parents have had, they pass it on to you. So he says, then when you again in your turn, you pass it on to your children, then you fade off. So you see, for them it is so simple. So he says, there's nothing beyond that. So that is the before is what? He says, through the bodies of the parents, through seed and gene and chromosome. And the after of the body would be a dissolution into the material elements, and the after of the conscious being a relapse into matter with some survival of the effects of its activity in the general mind and life of humanity. So this is the typical human consciousness at present. We are born from the conception of the parents, we bring to ourselves the genes, we live our lives, we pass it on to our children, and then when we leave the body, well, the body goes back to matter. So from matter it was born, and from matter it returns. So there's a big question of spirituality and soul and all that. So what have you done? What have you left behind? Yes, your progeny. And maybe a little on a higher level, the effects of its activity in the general mind and life of humanity. Well, if you have been a rich man, maybe you have given a job to 5,000 people. If you have done that, you have built 2 hospitals or you have built 2 schools. You leave behind those schools that effect, you know, that have an effect for some time. That hospital and those schools will remember you for a decade, 2 decades, 3 decades, and then you are out and it goes on. So he says, this is the simple philosophy. So why do we question the before and the after? And this, so a relapse into matter with some survival of the effects. This last quite illusory survival would be our only chance of immortality. You see, very simple thing, there is nothing called immortal. The only thing is, yes, Alexander the Great is immortal. Because, you know, he has lasted so many centuries. Socrates is immortal because he has lasted 7 centuries. The Buddha is immortal. He lasted 2,500 centuries. So it's just the lasting of time. So we call them immortal, those who have lasted the test of time over centuries. So we remember them as Buddha, as Christ, as Alexander, as Napoleon, because they have lasted time. And the effect that they have left behind. You know, the influence that Napoleon has had on Europe is still there, the Napoleonic code. Da Vinci's influence is still there, with the great discoveries he has made. So these are the things, and mankind understands this alone to be what is immortality. But since the universality of matter can no longer be held as giving any sufficient explanation of the existence of mind, and indeed matter itself can no longer be explained by matter alone, for it does not appear to be self-existent, we are thrown back from this easy and obvious solution to other hypotheses. So this is the first hypothesis, the simple hypothesis of matter is the reality. So if this is the way you believe, that there is nothing in this world except you are born from your parents, you die, then you, as you said, as it is said, body goes back to matter, and then what you leave behind is a name, is an effect of your work for some decades or centuries or years, depends on the person. But then Sri Aurobindo says, but this is all about the body. But can matter explain to us, how is it that this person was such a big artist? Was such a great philosopher? What was the source of the birth of this mind and this artistic sense or the artistic genius? Body I can understand, it was born from genes, chromosomes, etc., it lives, it dies. But how did this matter bring about this mind? Well, again the scientists would say, you know, this is again a matter of chromosome, a matter of chemicals. You know, they say even love is a kind of a chemistry. H2O or H1O or H5O, it depends on what they find as a formula you have. Your intense love or your passion or your no passion, your watery passion. It's all chemical formula. But then he says, that cannot explain. And finally he says, for it does not appear to be self-existent. That's the main argument of Sri Aurobindo. We have said from the parents the child is born. Fine. But how was the matter of your parents, how did it come about? So you will say, from his parents, and we say ad infinitum recession. Okay, you go back to ad infinitum, fine. Then you reach a point of animals, when there is no mankind. Then you say, okay, animals are also born, fine, go back to plant. Okay, you go back to matter. Then you say, well, nothing was there, only there is planet. So at a point when you say, what was there behind even your Big Bang? Now scientists say, sorry, I don't know, beyond that I don't know. So it's not self-existent, matter is not born, swayambhu. So if you really ask the scientists, what is the source of this great matter? There our great Einstein said, matter equals energy. Whatever your formula, E is equal to mc squared. So for the first time he says, no, matter is actually energy. So now we have something that the source of matter is energy. So matter is not Swayambhu, it's not self-born, it's not self-existent. It was born out of energy. So we can receive to that extent where we say energy is this foundation and source of matter. Now the next question is, what is that energy? Is energy also self-existent? Is it Swayambhu? Now there comes Indian philosophy and theory. This tapas is linked with chit. It is always chit tapas. So energy also is not self-existent. Energy belongs to a consciousness. And that consciousness is called Sat, Chit and Anand. So that's where India comes forward with its solution to all the greatest scientific problems. But alas, we have to wait until a scientist from the West tells us this secret. We will not believe it. Another Prince of Chopra has to come to say, oh, you know, behind energy there is a consciousness. Then only we will all believe. Otherwise, if our Vedas and Upanishads tell us, we say, we don't know, we have doubt about it. So that is the truth about it.